Today on Maine Calling, Maine's interstate highways. There are four interstate highways in Maine: I-95 from Kittery to Holton, I-195 in Saco, I-295 from Scarborough to West Gardner, and I-395 in Bangor and Brewer. Of course, many states now have much bigger networks of superhighways than Maine, but did you know that Maine was one of the first states in the nation to have an interstate highway system at all? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will look back at the history of the highways in Maine, what their impact has been, and why they continue to generate controversy every few years. From turnpike widening referendums to the Gorham Connector pushback, highways tend to represent different things to different people. Maine's superhighways on Maine Calling, that's just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maine's major highways have connected people traveling by car and truck for decades. Today, we'll discuss their history and their impact on communities. Joining me, Peter Mills, who is Executive Director of the Maine Turnpike Authority, Julie Larry, Senior Architectural Historian with Black Diamond Consultants, and Bruce Van Note, Commissioner of the Maine Department of Transportation. We invite you to join the conversation, but if you're driving, do so safely, please. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, the number 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today, as we are definitely into travel season for sure, especially with the beautiful weather we've had recently. Peter Mills, I'm going to start with you. I understand that when the Maine Turnpike was built, it was only the second superhighway built in America after the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Tell us about that. Tell us how the I-95 came to be, and then about when it grew and how that happened.
Actually, the first one was the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and it was built with a lot of federal money injected at the time. And Maine passed a law that said that created the Turnpike Authority as an entity, as an agency. And then they said, go out and borrow some money and build it. The Turnpike in 1945, 46, and 47 got no money. And the war came along. The statute was passed in 1941, right before Pearl Harbor. And then nothing happened until 1945 and 46. And then an engineer came back and said, we'll design it for you. And you're going to have to pay. You don't have to pay us unless you sell your bonds. And it got designed, and it went from Kittery or Portsmouth, really, all the way up to South Portland, and ended in South Portland at that juncture. That is the first part. And the turnpike went out and took a lot of farmland, because a lot of those towns south of us had not been developed yet. They paid on average $100 an acre for property in Wells and York and Kennebunk and places like that. Reading the old minutes of their meetings is quite interesting. So it opened, and in large measure, it created the post-war tourism industry completely. I mean, Maine changed dramatically overnight in terms of people coming home from the war, bought a car, had a family, and where do you go? You go up the coast. And that's what happened. People from Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey began streaming in, and then skiing came into its own. And so at all seasons of the year, the turnpike is really a huge part of what supports Maine's largest industry.
Peter, what was the impetus for it? Was it somebody saying this will bring tourism, or was there another reason for building it, and tourism was an unintended consequence?
Well, there was tourism, but they couldn't get here. They were on Route 1. And we've got up on our website some of the photographs that were taken at the time when people had to rely on Route 1 and Route 1A even to get up the coast. And it was impossible. You couldn't get through places like Kennebunkport and little towns that we have. Now, those towns are accessible because you come up the turnpike, take an exit, and bang, you're there. And it just changed the accessibility of these very attractive locations.
Like, all right, and was it extended not much later in the 50s? I want to turn to you, Bruce. Let's talk about the other highways, the other super highways in Maine. People may not think of 195, 295, and 395 as interstate highways, but they are. When did they come into being, and what was the thinking behind them?
Well, just if you really talk in history, I will talk about those, but history obviously goes back to before highways, right? When rivers were the mode of transportation, and the first highways were for mass, for ships. And to this day, there's Mass Landing and Freeport Road from that kind of stuff. And then it evolved through King's Highway and then Post Roads. You've heard of that. And then Stagecoach Roads. So throughout history, DOT and its predecessors have been responding to demand from the public. And in the highways that you're talking about, fast forwarding, which is relatively recent in history, to the interstate highway system. This was an interstate highway, the Eisenhower Interstate Highway and Defense System. And it was both economic prosperity and connectedness of the whole country. And it was seen both for economic opportunity and for security, for defense. So that was the reason. And with that, the federal government paid 90% of the cost of those highways. And so, and that system actually started soon in the late 50s and then wasn't completed until I was working here nationally, but it's been done for about 20 years.
Right. So anybody who's relatively new to Maine doesn't remember a time when these didn't exist. Julie, I'm going to turn to you. You have studied the history of I-295 in particular. I-295 goes from Scarborough to West Gardner. Give us a sense of what you learned. How did it come about? And what are some of the impacts of 295?
Sure. So I-295, primarily the area that I've studied, is it's been its impact in southern Maine, in particular the greater Portland, Portland Peninsula and the Deering neighborhoods. And it really had a fairly significant impact in that it bisected several neighborhoods, historic neighborhoods, and cut them off from so that they were no longer walkable, so that you couldn't walk to the store or because you suddenly had a highway in between you and the other side of your neighborhood. And it also removed a lot of housing units. And as everyone knows in Maine, housing is a big priority right now. And during the urban renewal and the highway projects that were happening in Greater Portland in the 50s and 60s, we lost about 2,800 units of housing.
I'm curious about that, Julie. I know that when the Franklin Arterial was built, which is one of the big exits off of 295 mm-hmm. in Portland, a lot of housing was removed for that. But the highway itself, 295, where were those homes that you're talking about? Were they in what we call Bayside now? Were they down by Forest Avenue? Where were their neighborhoods?
Sure. So East Deering, out towards where the Falmouth, where the bridge is over to Falmouth, that neighborhood lost some housing, as well as kind of the Oakdale USM area around Forest Avenue. Bayside didn't lose too many houses for 295 because much of that is actually built on fill over Back Cove. And then the other neighborhood is kind of the St. John and Libbytown neighborhoods over towards the Amtrak and Concord bus station.
And Peter, I know that I'm going to turn back to you because I know that the Turnpike is always doing a lot of planning and talking about what needs to happen, whether you're talking about building new toll plazas or the Gorham Connector or something else. How do you balance how a highway change or expansion will affect neighborhoods, will affect communities with what you're trying to do to make travel more efficient?
The purpose of the Turnpike is to prevent the invasion of municipal properties and housing. One of the big projects we just finished in the last several years is improving the capacity around the south and western sides of Portland so that traffic would not overburden 295, because 295 has got lots to do. And there are people, but it should be a road that is primarily useful for getting in and out of Portland and shouldn't be a through road to go, go north up the coast or what have you. So the Turnpike with the Falmouth Spur is a way of keeping commuters, traffic from cars that are coming in to visit, and also truck traffic, keeping it on a road that is built to handle through traffic and keep it out of the way of housing, have it so that it doesn't interfere with housing, and so that housing areas can be isolated from this traffic that just wants to get to a destination somewhere within the state. Two different, very different purposes.
And Bruce, let me ask you, because Julie's talking a lot about, we're looking back 50, 60, 70 years, and when Americans thought a lot differently about what it meant to build big highways and what the words urban renewal meant. And, we've learned a lot since then. And I'm wondering, when you plan projects, what are some of the lessons of the past that you apply now?
Great question. And Julie's statements are right on about what happened to housing with 295. I just note it was invited by city leader. That was what the public was demanding at the time. We can debate that. In fact, we have taken some lessons from that. We have a project down in Libby Town where we're trying to get the walking back into Libby Town. With walking, you can start thinking about more dense housing. We actually have a program now that we call the Village Program, because I think in the 60s and 70s, we were focused on vehicular mobility. There is no question about it. That was the goal. That's what people tasked us with. That's what they saw as the, what life should be at that time. Right now, we're actually in the process of working with communities where we take up pavement in some places, and we add sidewalks, and we have connecting trails, and we think about transit. So it's all part of, instead of project thinking and just point A and point B, think more in terms of systems thinking and how they all work together. And so we actually do have programs that we seek special federal funding to kind of, especially what I call in the areas of human scale, where the speed should be at human scale and not vehicular scale, we have those programs. With that said, rural states like Maine still love their highways. I mean, people in the urban areas, I think we have to be thinking much more in terms of complete streets and systems. But when you get to the outskirts, I will tell you that the vast majority of Maine like to be able to get there from here. They live in Maine because they might want to live downtown. They might want to eat in Portland, but they want to go skiing and they want to go to the beach, and they may want to go to the county. And the public support for highways in rural states like Maine remains very strong, whether you look at bond issues or anything else, or voting or work up in the legislature. I just think we have to, DOTs, and that's happening, DOTs have to shift and think different tools for different jobs. Rural areas may be one thing, but when you get down to human scale, let's get the traffic moving slower and start thinking more about bikes, pedestrians, and that stuff. And the divided highways, as Peter said, actually allows that to happen. And it's been doing that for a long time. That Route 1 going around Damariscotta, Noble Borough is a controlled access highway. You don't see a bunch of land use there. So the through traffic goes there. And that allows Damariscotta and Newcastle to be local traffic, local people. And Down East Magazine voted Damariscotta and Newcastle, you know, like the, one of the best places to live in Maine. So I always, a road needs to know what it is and what customers it's serving. And when you think in a system, one road can actually help the livability of other areas. So it's system thinking is a big theme that we're trying to think of. Think of cause and effect. And
That makes complete sense. And you look at the debate in places that, you know, I've lived in Maine 30 years, the debate in Wiscasset, for example, about what to do with the road there. It's not as straightforward as one might think. Julie, you're you're going to be a speaker at a conference coming up called the Portland Leviathan Conference. Tell me about that.
Sure. It's going to be a group of individuals getting together to talk about what could be the potential for the Libbytown neighborhood now, as Bruce mentioned, that they have some work that's going on to reconnect the neighborhood. And it's going to be looking at the past, which is where I'm going to be talking about. And then it's going to be talking about what's the future possibility for bringing in some density of housing, for having this expanded trail network through the neighborhood.
All right. Well, we are talking about highways in Maine, interstate highways, divided highways in Maine, not the rural routes. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today's topic, Maine's highways and the role they play. My guest today, Peter Mills, who is Executive Director of the Maine Turnpike Authority, Commissioner Bruce Van Note with the Maine Department of Transportation, and Julie Larry, Senior Architectural Historian with Black Diamond Consultants. Share your comments and questions by email, a brief email, please. We have many coming in. The email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to start with an email from Halia. She writes, I am someone who is taught that speed limits are the law, not a suggestion, and not a recommendation to drivers. No one follows the speed limit on Route 95. People from away and Maine drive well above the sign limits, and they speed through work areas where speeds are posted lower. For the safety of highway workers, I have witnessed some very close calls due to high speed. Why do speed limits go unenforced on Route 95 in Maine? Peter, I know you're not with the Maine State Police, but I suspect you chat with him from time to time.
No, more than that. We support an entire troop of the Maine State Police. We have about 25 Maine State Police officers whose cars and payroll and benefits and everything are reimbursed to the state by the Maine Turnpike. And at any given moment in time, there are at least 7 troopers with blue lights available on that road. And at other times, there are more than 7 or 8 or 9. And when we have heavy construction requirements, when we've got to close a couple lanes, when it gets difficult to maintain or to control traffic while we're doing construction work, we will have 1 or 2 troopers right on scene, and we pay them to be there to make sure that people obey the blue lights when they're seen and when they're available. Our contractors are frequently asking us, you know, to have troopers out there because it's the safest possible environment for them when they're out doing paving or guardrail repairs. I don't know. We do enforce the law. Those troopers do enforce the law. They don't work for me directly. They are state employees, but we contribute. We pay 100% of their costs to the state. We are understaffed. So is the entire Maine State Police. They don't have enough Maine police officers in Maine to fill the number that are thought to be required. So that may be one thing.
Let me me ask a follow-up question. Yeah, I know that in other places there are cameras now, speed cameras. Has that been discussed in Maine, or is there a reason that it's not something that, Bruce, you're smiling. I'm going to turn to you on that. Has the
need
idea
the legislature
of
to help us out with that?
Yeah, that would take the legislature. For in England, supposedly, I think you just get a ticket if you've been caught speeding on the camera.
Yeah, I actually had the experience of testifying in favor of a bill to do exactly that a long time ago. I think I've been there two or three times, including in work zones. I really like the comment about the work zones because, you know, both Peter and I have lost people in these work zones. So it's not just a theoretical kind of thing at all. The long and the short of it is there's a contingent of Big Brother and freedom that policy-wise the legislature has not been comfortable with yet. The technology is there. It could happen, but that just has not been something, and it's not just Maine. It's been across the country that started with red light enforcement and other things. So what we've shifted to is using the technology for lack of a better term, education and a little bit of shame. You know, when you go through the construction zones and it says 55 and it lights up at 72, most people it can shock you into slowing down. And I do know that the state police, I mean I know the commissioner and the colonel, and they are short-staffed. But they take highway safety very seriously. So it's the legislature just has not been willing to go there, and it's been discussed, I think, two or three times over the last 20 years, and they have not been willing to do that yet.
An email here from Eric, and I'm actually not sure who would be the best person to answer this, so raise your hand if you are. Eric writes, I am a health researcher, and no research by Tufts University has shown negative health effects of urban highways in Somerville, Massachusetts. What do we know about the health effects of 95 and 295 cutting through urban populated areas such as 295 in Portland? Has that been studied by, as far as you all know? No? Okay. We'll move on then. We are going to go to you, Peter, because we have lots of questions about the Gorham Connector. We will not spend this entire program talking about them, but I will ask this one from Holly. Building and maintaining this unnecessary connector is going to exacerbate climate change, not to mention environmental degradation and loss of wildlife habitat. As a lifelong resident of this area, I bemoan the population growth I've seen and the negative impact it's had on our fast diminishing natural world. It's high time we humans look at the destruction we are causing and decide we don't need a faster commute at such high cost.
I drove yesterday against traffic going west on Route 22, which is also the county road out past Smiling Hill Farm and other areas that go out toward Buxton. And I did a quick count and saw 700 motor vehicles stopped, attempting to come east, waiting for traffic to clear up ahead of them at various intersections that were blocking them from getting to work or doing whatever they wanted to do. That is the worst thing for the environment, to have those people idling out there, not going anywhere, not getting to where they need to go. And it's a waste of human productivity for them to do that. This happened in part, well, it's been Route 22, which goes out through South Gorham and North Scarborough, has been overburdened with traffic for many decades. So has Route 25 that goes through Gorham and Westbrook. It's called the Ossipee Trail. Back in 2007, a bypass was built through cross country to relieve the traffic through the middle of Gorham itself, the Route 25 passage, and it helped a lot. The problem is they dumped all of that traffic came into the little village of South Gorham and North Scarborough, adding to the previous congestion that they had on Route 22 or the county road. It is now the worst congestion in the state of Maine every day. It's horrible. And somehow that it has to be addressed. It's also part and parcel of it, it ties into the housing shortage as well. That it's a whole other subject, but transportation and housing are interrelated very deeply. And I'm all in favor of high density housing so that we have, you know, we have fewer burdens on the transportation system.
Julie, I'm going to turn to you a little bit for this because it is, we're doing a whole series here on Maine Calling of this entire year about the housing shortage and looking at it from so many different angles. And I've already done 5 or 6 programs on this. Maine needs, it's estimated 80,000 new homes very soon. We have a shortage not only of state troopers, but nurses, doctors, teachers, you fill in the blank. And part of it is because they can't find places to live. How is this tied in with what you do when you study transportation? I'm guessing that how we've thought about housing and transportation in the past and how we're thinking about it today and how we need to think about it in the future are right at, you know, that's the crux of the work that you do.
Sure. So I actually probably come at it from the other direction. I, as an architect background, I've been looking at buildings, and then you look at them in the context of their neighborhoods, and you realize as you're studying the development of a community that that's largely impacted by the transportation network. So many cities were expanded because they had streetcar systems, and the development followed those streetcar routes. And now those many of those streetcar routes are public transit routes. And so I think that what we really need to do as we go forward is if we look at the ways that development of transportation networks and land use planning worked together and created communities that people wanted to live in that were walkable, where they had transportation options and options for shopping, you know, much closer to home than having to get in their car. I think that's a way that we can inform our land use and transportation projects going forward, that they really need to work in concert.
And Bruce, this is part of the village concept that you all are working on, correct?
It is, but it's broader, and transit-oriented development and density in the right places and all that makes perfect sense, and especially in Greater Portland. I mean, where you have that density, where transit services can be more easily supported, you get into rural areas and it is more challenging. And I hear all the time about you just have to expand transit out into the rural areas. And that's a challenge across the country. And a lot of people, when they think about rural transit, it's actually kind of demand response. They want to ride coming to their house because it's that rural. And that's a different challenge, and one we have to work into, and volunteer drivers and all that, and networks are things that we have to work on. But the connection, roads have always been in this state from the earliest time, responding to public demand, to customer demand. And I think Julie's right that we, especially given the cost of housing, denser and makes all the sense in the world. But local zoning affects that, right? I mean, how high can you go in Portland? That's a big debate. And how high do people in Maine want to live in? Quite honestly, there are a bunch of people who, when they move to Maine, they are thinking still about single family and that kind of stuff. So how can we take that green space in the parks? Some of the best neighborhoods were the ones done before, the old ones, right? You know, the ones done way before the private automobile. But you have to add on that the public demand for connectedness. Before the highway system in Maine got really developed, which really started with the invention of the Model T and all the way up through the time we talked about, it's always been about getting connected. And the United States have always come down on, we should connect, whether it's by road, electricity, telephone, or now the internet, that everyone should be connected. And so that has led, and especially there's an expectation in Maine. I think it's part of our brand. You talk to people who move here from Boston or New York, says, I can live here and I can ski in 45 minutes and then go to the beach in 45 minutes, and I can go camping in an hour and a half and be in the middle of the woods and not hear another living soul. That's part of what it is to be in Maine. And that's the demand, and we're just responding to that. We don't build roads just to build roads. I have no desire. In fact, Maine hasn't. There were 25,000 public roads in 1905. There's 23,000 today. We have not been on a road building spree, except for the interstate highway system. That absolutely true. That did happen in the 50s. We've been in a road improvement program since the beginning. It was first just to get out of the mud and control the dust. And then it was just to connect people so that farmers could get their products in and sell it to more people instead of just bartering. It's always been about the economics and the quality of life and safety.
Calling in now is Maria Fuentes, who's executive director with Maine Better Transportation Association. Thanks for calling in, Maria, and tell us what Maine Better Transportation Association focuses on.
Sure. Thank you, Jennifer. So we were founded in 1939 as the Maine Good Roads Association. In 1983, we changed our name to the Maine Better Transportation Association, recognizing that we need to look at the transportation system as a whole and make sure that the different modes work together. It was not too long after the Maine DOT changed their name from the Maine Highway Commission. And so what we do is we advocate for funding for transportation infrastructure. And we do that to improve the quality of life, safety, and economic well-being of people. So our members are companies or organizations or individuals who plan, design, build, maintain, and use the state's infrastructure. So we have a lot of design engineers. We have transportation construction companies, public works, the major airports, bus companies, marine, and so that's who we are.
So you're multimodal. Today we're talking about highways. What do you think is important to add to this conversation? What when you're thinking about the big divided highways in Maine, what do you think the future we need to be thinking about for the future?
Well, I think that Maine has good highways. I think the challenge is going to be how to maintain those highways. Obviously, the cost is very high, and there aren't a lot of people in Maine to spread that cost among. You know, we're lucky that because tourism is our first, is our largest industry, we're certainly fortunate. The Maine Turnpike is such a good road because the Turnpike is really the gateway to Maine, and so we can share the cost with the tourists. And I know that the Turnpike has worked hard to spread it out so that, you know, people from away are covering a much bigger chunk of the cost. But I think that the big challenge is going to be how we continue to maintain it. I mean, there aren't a lot of requests for new roads, right? We do have a lot of roads. I mean, certainly, I think the Gorham Connector is an important stretch, but I really think that maintaining and improving it is going to be the biggest challenge. We don't see people. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just trying to. We need to go to a break, so I was trying to wrap you up. Final words.
Well, the only other thing is that, you know, the impact of the interstate on Maine has just been really immeasurable. I think the commissioner mentioned connectivity, but it opened us up to the rest of the country and provided opportunities that simply didn't exist before. And certainly when companies are thinking about expanding or moving, one of the first things they want to find out is the transportation connections.
Well, I really appreciate you calling in. Maria Fuentes is the executive director of the Maine Better Transportation Association. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing Maine's highway system. And with me, Maine DOT's Bruce Van Note, who's the commissioner, architectural historian Julie Larry, and the Maine Turnpike Authority's Peter Mills. I will say you can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, but I think that our lines are full, so you can try. And I just want to quickly, Bruce, go to what Maria was talking about before the break, that her biggest concern is funding Maine's highways in the future. I suspect you agree.
Yes. I mean, it's just taking care of what you got. And I know there's been, in fact, we considered it, like, can we get have less roads so we have less to take care of? I will tell you that that is everyone's road is the one most important road is the one that goes in front of their house. And that has not been something that on a policy wise we'll be able to do. So we have just some basic structural challenges. We got 35,000 square miles, 8,800 miles of state highway, 2,700 bridges, and 1.3 million people spread out. You can put all the rest of the New England states in Maine almost. So that just means we have a lot of infrastructure per person. But the good news is at the federal level, there was a bipartisan infrastructure law that goosed federal funding. And the Maine legislature stepped up to provide match and provide some state funding. So as long as that kind of continues, we're going to be able to, we're not building anything gold-plated. We're managing it. It's not all just MacGyver duct tape and baling wire. We are able to do some things because of that grant funding in the villages and those kinds of things, which are very expensive, of course, when you're moving curbs and drainage systems and all that kind of stuff. So DOT has pivoted just in the last few years from what I would just say making do to making some progress. And most of it is built on those major highway connections. And by the way, it's not just interstate system, because an awful lot of part of the state doesn't have an interstate. And so the national highway system, the Route 2s and 4s and that are also critical. And so yes, funding is always an issue. Right now we're in better shape. And as long as we don't fall back or costs don't double again, it's the toughest job you'll ever love, taking care of the highway system in Maine, and we love it, and it has huge impact on every Maine person every day. So we'll stay at it.
I'm having a little bit of technical problem here, but I'm going to try to go back to the phones. And Zach calling from Portland. Zach, can you hear me? Zach, are you there? Darn it, I was worried about that. I'm going to go to another email here. This is kind of lovely. This is from Brad. He says, Ben Franklin established mile markers along the post road in 1769. And he says, there's one last marker left in the side of the road off Route 1 in Ogunquit, hence the name for the Milestone Motel on Route 1 in Ogunquit. And he writes, in 1939, MDOT created a test stretch 4 lanes wide from York Corner to the entrance of York Wild Kingdom. And he says, after serving in the Navy in World War II, my dad, Elroy Moulton, worked briefly on the turnpike in the late 40s, before beginning 30 years working on the Kittery Navy Yard. And he says, say hi to Peter Mills for me. So thanks for that. We have several emails here. And let's see, I'll go to this one, an email from James. I would like to know why the conversation, particularly with regard to the Gorham Connector, is not considering commuter or light rail. One more lane, one more highway is not a long-term solution. We need to reduce the number of roads on the line. And then here from Owen, I'm happy to hear that your guests from MDOT are discussing road maintenance and improvement. Does the MDOT have any plans to make use of land it already owns along the interstate system to improve public transportation, such as devoted commuter carpool lanes, devoted bus lanes, or even commuter rail? So two related questions representing some others that we've gotten. People frustrated, we're just talking about highways here and not about alternative transportation. Bruce, I'll go back to you. Any thoughts about, you know, adding carpool lanes or light rail any place in Maine?
The light rail is just it comes down to a case of economics. And if you have enough density, you can consider those things. But in Maine, very quickly after you get out of certain areas, It just makes more sense to use the stranded capital costs in the highway system to use rubber-tired mass transit, which is transit, or buses. And so, but the idea of Portland, Greater Portland, has been talking about the concept of bus rapid transit for a long time. DOT has supported those conversations. We just have to get it down. Ultimately, you have to go local control, and you have to get to a town and go, are you willing to give up this stretch of parking or whatever, or a bike lane? There's only so much real estate from building to building. Julie, you know, those buildings that matter, we shouldn't be tearing up. You know, there's only so much space. That's what you have to get to. So they are challenging to site, but I think they're the right thing. Rubber tires just make more sense in a rural state like Maine to move people. We have park and ride lots. The carpool lanes, there isn't a congestion in most parts on the interstate highway system to justify that in a state like Maine. They're good suggestions, and it's all different tools for the job. If that tool fits the job we're trying to solve, we should be looking at it.
And I want to turn to my other guests as well on this question. I want to apologize to callers. We had a technical glitch. I lost all of you. So if anybody has been on hold for a while trying to get through, you can try one more time, 1-800-399-3566. Julie, what did you want to add to what Bruce said?
Well, for many years, I live in Biddeford, and for many years, I was a Zoom rider, which is a bus route that connects Biddeford and Saco to downtown Portland, and it's a great service. I really enjoyed using it, but I do enjoy working from home and not having to commute as much anymore.
And Peter, what do you want to add to the question about light rail or carpool lanes?
No, Zoom, fast-moving buses on highways that have adequate capacity is a really good solution to some. And it's neat for the housing crisis. For example, I mean, I was astonished. I visited Standish in my travels recently and found that I've lived here all my life in this area. And I found a huge housing development in the middle of town next to Hannaford's with, I think, as many as 300 manufactured homes. And I asked people, I said, what do you folks do for work? Oh, we drive to Portland to the hospital where we work as nurses and things like that. And I thought, oh my God, there should be a park and ride lot up here in addition to whatever parking they have. And there should be a bus running from Standish straight into town. And that's one of the things we've been talking about in connection with the Gorham Connector. It's a service that could be added to the road that we're building. But the people, there is a Husky line that Greg Jordan was successful in moving along that goes from Gorham into town in Portland. And he went to the University of Maine and he said, why don't you just give me a certain amount of money and you can have all of your students and all of your faculty ride that bus anytime they want. And he put a lot of people onto those buses that way. And he did it with the Maine Medical Center. So we need to be creative and supportive, and buses by their very nature need some measure of subsidy, either from the towns or from the state or from companies or the university, for example, but to keep them viable. But there needs to be more of that in Maine, no question about it. Rubber tires are know where they want to go.
We'll go to Zach calling from Portland. Hi, Zach, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for doing this subject, and I'm looking forward to the Leviathan event on June 20th. I think it's on the community calendar. I'd like to commend the state for getting a federal Reconnecting Communities grant for Portland. After 50 years of highways, they have an obvious benefit for the rural areas, they often are not such a great fit in cities. And cities across the country, particularly in the Northeast and as far, including a far place called Boston, are removing highways. In Milwaukee, they spend $25 million to remove a highway, but it would have cost three times that to maintain it, and it's generated $1 billion in economic development. And so my question is, is the state, the DOT, interested in looking into that, because the economic and social benefit is just staggering. Thanks again.
Bruce.
Thanks for the call, Zach. Like so much in Maine, I think it's the same kind of growth and density that are happening on some of the other cities you're talking about are just not the same in Maine. We are open to discussions. I mean, that, I think the shift in Libbytown, I mean, that was a DOT kind of driven kind of project. And but the idea, I don't think, again, we're a public service agency, and what do the customers demand? I'm not sure even the city of Portland, who is well known to be more progressive than other areas in Maine, would be ready to take up I-295. Just the impacts of that to the economic vitality of the area would be, I don't think it's a set question. Zach, obviously, I know where Zach stands on the issue. These things have, public policy is a combination of a lot of different opinions, and I just don't think it would be there to do that. And it would take that kind of widespread regional, because it affects more than just the environs of Portland. I mean, it affects a bunch of other towns.
Zach, thank you so much for your call. Let's see, we'll try to squeeze in one or two more. We'll go to Frank calling from Brooklyn, Maine. Hi, Frank, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just curious if the East-West Highway that's been talked about over the years is something that's still on the table or just been written off?
Oh. Peter, you know the answer.
Yeah, well, it was never officially done, but it just lost its energy. And that was a challenge. Again, it's always the same thing. Capital cost versus number of users to how much would it cost? And when you started doing math of like how many hundreds of dollars per truck you might need, it just loss of energy. And in that particular case, I support that conclusion. We also did a study recently. I went up to the county several times where I was born and just said overtly, we're not building a divided highway another 90 miles from Holton North. So because it just, the economics weren't there. And instead what's happened is investment in freight rail has through federal grants and otherwise have allowed us to address at least some of, more reasonably address the freight needs of that area. So
thanks,
I don't
Frank.
Think it's not something I'm thinking about every day. I will tell you that.
Thank you, Frank. Going to Winston calling from Portland. Hi, Winston. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Winston in Portland. So last week I was inbound on the bike ped path over Tukey's Bridge, where Washington and 295 kind of combine for a moment before Washington Avenue goes back to being Washington Avenue. And I saw the aftermath of a 6-car pileup on the outbound side of the bridge. And my question is 295's current form as an interstate highway, kind of, compatible with the Greater Portland Council of Governments Vision Zero plan, which commits to reach zero traffic fatalities by 2045, or does 295 running through Portland depend on some suffering injury and destruction of personal property to function?
Winston, we're almost out of time. I'm going to let Bruce talk about that stretch of 295 that we're talking about. Everybody who drives through Portland knows it, where you see people who are doing the Back Cove Trail or something like that right next to the highway. Any plans to do something different there, Bruce?
Well, if people know that area, that is a that is a tight, complicated area. There's no question about it. And all highways, everyone's vision is zero in terms of highway deaths. How you actually get to that practically would be a real challenge on any highway, including that. But the RU Institute has a plan there with, if that goes forward, there's a lot of bike connections. There's opportunities to make rail corridors in the area, a bike facility. There are connections that you make underneath to get Baxter Boulevard connected. So yeah, we're actually thinking a lot about that particular area. but it just shows you have to think in terms of system. You have to think of how you can serve bike pedestrian needs as well as the vehicular needs.
Winston, thanks for your call. I'm going to end by reading a positive email from Elizabeth, who writes, "Maine highways trace some of the best times of my life, past, present, and future. The turnpike has led me to family camps on Coppiciconti every year, and now all the way up to my younger sister living near Holton. Not only great memories and moments, but also pride, as my uncle Ernest Danford graded much of the pike and other highways throughout Maine. And what is a trip to Maine without stopping at the Welcome Center? In a few years, they will lead us to our retirement near Litchfield." So thank you for that. And thank you for our guest today. The voice you just heard, Bruce Van Note, Commissioner of the Maine Department of Transportation. Also with us, Julie Larry, a senior architectural historian with Black Diamond Consultants, and Peter Mills, Executive Director of the Maine Turnpike Authority. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.